As a literary agent, you know there's only one thing I like talking about more than books, and that's money. More importantly, cash that stays in your pocket. I'm on the lookout for our listeners at all times. I'm combing deal memos and book publishing contracts for hidden ways that writers are on the hook, and that's why we are thrilled to partner with Chime, who's changing the way people bank. They offer the most rewarding fee-free banking built just for you. That's right, built for you, not the 1%. Chime members can benefit from up to $1,150 in annual rewards, fee-free. Direct deposit unlocks the most rewarding way to bank at Chime. Chime is rated 5 stars by USA Today for customer service. That's real humans 24/7. You're not just switching banks, you're upgrading to America's number one choice for banking with a Chime checking account. They're not like traditional old banks that charge you overdraft and monthly fees. And if you're like me and travel a bunch and love premium travel perks like airport lounge access, you've got it. And the 24/7 travel concierge included with your Chime card. My younger self would have loved a fast-tracked airport lounge access. You get 5% cash back on Chime card in a category of your choice, like gas or groceries for your next writer's retreat. You get savings that grow faster with 3.75 APY. That's 9 times higher than the national average. You can even get up to $500 of your pay when you say, "With my pay." They also have SpotMe, which lets you overdraft up to $200 fee-free. Chime is not just smarter banking. It's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. Head to chime.com/tsnotya. That's chime.com/tsnotya. It only takes a few minutes to sign up.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a J.D. Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair.
Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Shooting the Shit. We do have two agents on the show today, myself and someone else, but in a very special episode, we have a special guest star. Aaliyah Hannah Habib is Vice President and Literary Agent at The Gurnert Company.
Good job. Sorry.
It's okay. It's going to be funny. Where she represents MacArthur Fellows, Pulitzer Prize winning journalists, National Book Award finalists, and numerous New York Times bestselling authors. She lives in Brooklyn, New York. And for everyone wondering why Aaliyah said, good job, in the middle of me reading her bio, it's because I was checking all the pronunciations with her before. So thank you.
People often mispronounce Gurnert, and it gets Tarjay'd a lot, so I've been introduced on many a panel as working at the Gurnet Company, which sounds incredibly chic and posh, but I do not work at the Gurnet Company. I work at Gurnert.
Interesting.
Bravo. That was great.
Amazing. Thank you. I will take the compliment. I will take the win. Our listeners have for sure heard me butcher some names unintentionally, of course. So I'm really happy. I'm not going to say it again, though, because what if I get it wrong the second time?
No.
But welcome.
Keep winning.
Welcome, Aaliyah.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay. So for context, you guys, Carly's traveling, and so she and I decided to each record an episode without each other because we had to, it was scheduling. And then Carly did her amazing episode last week, which I'm sure you guys checked out, and I was reading Aaliyah's book, because that's right, Aaliyah isn't just an agent, she is an author, and I'm going to hold up the book for you guys who are on YouTube. It's called Take It From Me, An Agent's Guide to Building a Nonfiction Writing Career from Scratch. And I want to share why I was reading this book. So I was reading this book because a good friend of mine who's an agent, Amanda, read it and loved it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to check it out. I trust Amanda's taste. And I was loving it too. And then I DM'd Aaliyah about how much I loved it. And when I knew I was recording an episode, a solo episode, well, not solo now, I was like, Aaliyah, will you come on and do it with me so we can talk publishing news, but also so I could ask her about her book. So in today's episode, everyone, we're going to obviously talk to Aaliyah and ask her a little bit about her career and her book. And then we're also going to cover a few stories in the news and some questions from our listeners. I don't know whether we'll have time to cover it all, but let's try. Aaliyah, first thing I want to know, because I'm so curious now, what made you want to write a book? As an agent, you know how hard it is. What made you want to do it?
I am not eager to write another one. So I think I'm probably hanging up my book writing hat because I mean, I think I always understood and respected how hard it is. And then I actually wrote a book and I get it in my bones now. I would say that my path towards writing a book is one that I think is actually a good way to think about whether or not you should write a book, which is I often do public speaking and I like it. And I like teaching classes and workshops. I've always enjoyed that part of the job. And it's not all agents do it. Not all agents have to do it. But I was teaching a little workshop at Stanford for academics that were interested in writing crossover books, trade books. And I loved doing it. And I was thinking, oh, it'd be so fun to do a semester long course. And I was like, so I have this little practice of taking a little nap every afternoon and I call it having my thoughts. So I was having my thoughts and thinking, I'm having my thoughts. It's like my sitting there. It's kind of like meditating, kind of like napping. And I was like, okay, if I were to teach a semester long class about nonfiction, what would it look like? And I was trying to put together a syllabus of what I would assign to read. And I kept pulling different ideas, but it all came from writing about publishing that was focused on fiction. And I thought, it's really a shame that there's not a book that's about nonfiction. And then I thought, oh, I could write that book that needs to be a book. So I think that process of thinking, oh, there needs to be a book about what I am uniquely qualified to do so is actually a really good test if you're thinking about a nonfiction book. It wasn't like I was searching around for a book idea. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like, oh, I have to write a book. It was more like the idea came to me fairly fully formed and then I followed it. And then in my case, I'm very lucky because I know a lot of agents. So I texted my really good friend and colleague, Meredith Kafel Simonoff, who's an agent, and said, Meredith, I have this idea. What do you think of this book idea? And she said, write a couple paragraphs, which is also really good advice if you have a book idea, is to actually, instead of just, you know, thinking about it in the shower, write it down, write it, try to formalize the idea. And I did that. I sent it to her. Next thing I knew, we were working on a book proposal. That was a rather long answer to your question, but
loved it. I loved it because, I mean, first of all, I learned that you take these power naps, which I love now. And
it's a great thing.
I suffer from insomnia. So to me, the idea of being able to nap is a superpower. It's like someone saying, I speak 15 languages. That's the equivalent. I can't nap. I cannot sleep at night, let alone during the day. But I love that that was your journey. I love that you said that you wanted the book to exist and then you were like, oh, I can write it. But that also means that you can't say you'll never write another book because maybe someday you'll be like...
It could be. Like that's the way I always think about it. If I wake up one day from a power nap, from my thoughts and have an idea where I think, oh my God, I have to write this book, I'd probably do it again. But I wouldn't do it for less than that kind of inspiration. Yeah. And I think also knowing how hard it is to write a book, it's not a hobby.
Not a hobby for sure. So what was something that was surprising to you? Because I feel that as an agent, a lot of the things that would normally be surprising to a first-time author probably weren't because you know so much. But then was anything surprising to you despite your experience?
So what was great and which I think proved the theory of the book, which is the more you know about the process, the less stressful it would be. Most things with the publication process, I did not find stressful or surprising. I felt very calm about it, I think. I think that I underestimated how without a net you feel when you're writing. Mm-hmm. Our work as agents, our work as publishing professionals is collaborative. We always talk about it as such. And there's always someone to bounce ideas off of. And sometimes that's the frustration is that you can't do it all on your own. You can't do the publicity and the marketing and the copy editing. But when you are writing, it's just on you. You are carrying the backpack up the mountain alone. The cavalry isn't coming. You have to put the words on the page. And I think that sense of total responsibility, knowing how that feels, I hope made me even more empathetic to my authors. You know, I would bounce ideas off of people, but it's not the same as getting your ass in a chair and having to write, you know, 10,000 words in a month or whatever I was very systematic about it. I had very clear word count goals and a schedule and stuff. And just like, I have to do it. There's nobody's coming to do this for me.
How long did it take you to write it?
Took me a little longer than I hoped because Hopefully this will make people feel sorry for me and buy my book. I got divorced in the middle and I had to move.
Wait,
I lost my
you
home.
You got divorced in the middle of writing your book?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. My marriage ended shortly after I got my book deal. Yeah. It's I'm so great now. Everything is so fine, but my life fell apart. So I lost my home.
Okay, but that's
home.
Like one of the hardest things a person can
do. It was
go
horrible.
While you're doing one of the most like
it was horrible.
Challenging
things
ever.
It was horrible. And then I had to move. Okay. So I was living in this weird rental by myself. Wow. It delayed it a little bit. So I think all in all, it took about 2 years. But okay. Also, I think that to get into kind of advice mode, I mean, it was horrible. It was the hardest year of my life. Yeah. The intense period where I was really writing the book. But it also, sometimes you have to draw from negative emotions to get things done. And I did. I thought, I mean, I lost my home. I lost my marriage. My marriage fell apart right before it happened. Our dog died. It was kind of like the dog was the final straw.
I mean,
it was a mess. I know. My life is so much better now. It's great. But to make happy endings do happen. But I remember thinking, I can't lose another thing. I can't have another L on the scorecard. And that's what got me up every day. And if that was it, then that was it. So it was kind of like a revenge book. The guy was like, I'm going to write this fucking book if it kills me.
So Princess Diana had the revenge
book.
Dress?
No, it's the revenge
right?
book.
She did.
Yes,
you
the
did,
famous
you have
revenge,
revenge
dress.
Book. Yeah.
You know, and I think that's okay. If you have to write your book as a revenge book, if that's what gets it done, then that's what gets it done.
I love it. It's your little black number. That
it's my little
showed
black
everyone.
Number.
I love that. Love the story. Okay, see, you're such a good storyteller because you just made me feel all the emotions and there was an
art. Oh my gosh, thank you.
So, okay, this is fascinating. I'm like totally reframing everything I read. Because here's the thing about your book as a reader of your book. I'm not attached to this book in any way. I read it and then I reached out to you. It's not like, you know, we had spoken before.
Mm-mm, we don't know each other, yeah.
Right, so I got into this like totally blind.
Thank you.
Yes. Do I think it's an agent's guide to building a nonfiction career for writers? I do. I also think it's an agent's guide to other agents. Like, I actually think
Thank
this
you.
Book is an invaluable resource for agents and other publishing professionals or anyone who's curious about the publishing industry because you break it down from various angles, which is unsurprising since you wear many hats, right? Like, you teach, you're an author, you're an agent, and that makes sense. And I love that you especially have the key takeaways at the end of each chapter and that you encourage the reader to, hey, if you're particularly interested in chapter 8, you don't have to wait till chapter 8. Read chapter 8 first or whatever chapter first, right? Like I really like that. You offer
Thank you.
Clear templates. And for any listener who's like, I've always been curious to know how an auction works or how an agent sends emails, Aaliyah actually shares the wording behind so many of her tools as an agent. And so if you're curious, I highly recommend it checking out,
Thank
not
you.
Just as a guide for nonfiction authors. I think so.
But I definitely wrote the book with that secondary audience in mind, other agents, publishing professionals, young
Was that
people
on your
who
proposal?
Want to work in publishing. Yes, absolutely.
Under the audiences? Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And also, it's not specifically marketed to fiction writers, but I want it to be a book that anyone who wants the parts of it that you could skip around. And I also think I think that one thing you can do in a nonfiction book is, without holding the reader's hand too much, tell them how to read it. So I do that in the introduction, exactly that, right? They say, you don't have to read this in order. Skip ahead. Don't worry about the stuff at the end if you're not there in your career. And I really, my style as a writer is a lot like my style as a speaker. I'm a pretty narrative writer, but it's a prescriptive book. So that's why I wanted to have the takeaways. So some, if you read the book and you're like caught up in this, there's jokes, there's a thong song joke in my book. Like there I want is. It to be fun, but I also don't want you to then be like, oh, I read a fun chapter. What did I learn? I really wanted you to also know what you learned. And that's why I did the takeaways at the end. So that way you could read it on a couple different levels. So a fair amount of thought went into the format.
I love that. That's super interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. So, okay, now we're going to talk about today's news and also some questions from listeners.
I love questions.
But before we go to that, Aaliyah, is there a question about your book that I didn't ask you that you're like, ooh, I wish someone would ask me that.
Oh, gosh.
putting you on the spot. That's
you're
what
you're putting
do
me on the spot. Here's a question that I think will be helpful to writers, which is, what did you learn about the writing process while writing the book? Hmm. Which is different than what surprised you. So this is my writing advice, which I couldn't have known until I wrote my book. I had a really hard time writing the book's first chapter, which in my book is the first chapter I wrote for my sample for selling the book is on querying, pitching articles and essays. That was easy to write. I know that really well. That was fun to write. Second chapter is about education. It's about MFA programs, journalism school, whether or not to do graduate degree. And that was challenging because that was the only chapter that I don't have super direct experience with. I wasted 6 months of my life trying to write that chapter. And it was like right after the divorce, I was a mess. And I honestly thought, I can't finish this book. What am I going to do? It's going to be so embarrassing. Then one day I woke up and I thought, what if I were to write the easiest chapter next? Mm-hmm. So I actually wrote my book from easiest to hardest chapter. I didn't write in order. Interesting. And I wrote from chapter that I thought would be most fun to write to chapter I thought would be least fun to write. And the reason that worked for me is it was my first book and I needed to learn how to write chapters. And I knew I'd feel more confident the more word count I had under my feet, kind of like running a marathon. Like, you know, if you get to mile 19, you're going to make it to the mm-hmm. end. But mm-hmm. I was just stuck. Like, it was like I'd given myself a hill to climb really early by having the hard chapter come first. And I was kept thinking I had to write in order. So once I wrote out of order, everything became so much easier. Then by the time I got to the hard chapter, the education chapter, I'd written all the other chapters and it just felt so much easier. And I had a rhythm and I had a better ideas about the structure. So that was my advice. And I think it could work for fiction. I think it could work for nonfiction. You know, you don't have to, my colleague Nicole calls it eating the frog for breakfast. If you know you have to eat a frog during the course of your workday, and I get this, I'm a good girl. Like, I'm like, I'll get eat the frog first. Maybe you don't have to. Maybe you can do the easier things first and work up to the hard thing. So that's my writing advice.
Yes. I don't want to eat a frog.
I mean, I don't think anyone should ever have to eat a frog.
Yes.
No, like, no shade.
My frog is kale. I don't want to eat kale.
Oh, I love kale.
No, this is wrong. No. Chocolate chip cookies.
I mean, I love chocolate chip cookies too. My frog is tuna fish. I think should never be no human should eat that. Are you a cat?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you shouldn't be eating fish from a can.
Yeah. Yes, agreed. Hard agree. I'm a very picky eater. All right. Well, thank you for that, Aaliyah. I loved that extra question. We are now going to take a break for a message from our sponsors.
In an age where everything looks the same online, finding ways to express my personal interior design style is crucial to feeling like my space, well, feels like me. I've gone from student to young professional to parent of young kids, and I keep coming back to Wayfair. There's always furniture and home goods that help me express where I'm at in my life and budget while honoring my individual taste. From renovating my bathrooms in our 90s house to updating playrooms for my kids as they grow, Wayfair always rises to the occasion. My Wayfair finds are endless, but one I really loved was a powder room bathroom vanity that was the exact size I needed for a small space. I didn't have an inch to spare, and Wayfair was there. Wayfair has the items you can't find anywhere else and delivers them seamlessly. If you know what you're looking for, and even if you don't, you can use Wayfair's Verified as a shortcut to the good stuff. Their team of product specialists vet everything by hand using a 10-point inspection, testing things like quality of materials, functionality and features, and even how long it takes to build. My newest living room bookshelf is the 65-inch tall arched storage bookshelf with adjustable shelves, arched cabinet, and a drawer. And it was Wayfair's Verified, and I knew the assembly was going to be smooth. It fits my style, my space, and I smile every time I reach for something on the shelf because it's a reflection of how I want my space to look, polished, modern, and functional. I order from Wayfair whenever I have a specific household need, and you should too. With over 20 million five-star reviews, you are not buying blind. See real customers, real homes, real feedback before anything hits your cart. Ready to upgrade your home for way less? Head to Wayfair.com right now to shop all things home and get your space ready for less. That's Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi, everyone. It's time to register for the next beta reader matchup, with the matchup emails going out on the 8th of September. As per usual, you'll be submitting 3,000 words from your work in progress, and I'll be matching you up with writers in similar time zones and or genres. Many of the beta reader groups turn into writing groups with a lot of longevity, which is always marvelous to see. To sign up, go to my website, biancamurray.ca, and go to the beta reader matchup page. I look forward to matching you.
All right, everyone, welcome back. We are now going to talk about a few headlines. The first, this is good news for romance writers. Where are our romance writers? Let us know in the comments if that's you. Atria Gallery Group, technically, is relaunching Pocket Books imprint. And I thought that was so cool. I think we talk so much about like imprints closing and people being laid off. Whenever we see a new imprint opening, I'm like, yay, let's celebrate that.
Same. Always good news. Always good news.
I love that. So if you write romance, you should be happy. But also if you write romantic thrillers, dark romance, horror, the news does say that the imprint expects to launch 2 to 3 titles per month starting in January 2027. So exciting. Exciting
news.
That's
robust. That's great.
Yeah. That's really robust. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, then the other thing that happened quite recently, and I really hope I'm pronouncing her name right, Tomi Adeyemi is distancing herself from her Children of Blood and Bone adaptation. I read a little article in The Guardian about it, but I also saw her post, and I have no idea what's going on, if I'm being totally honest, because I don't think we're supposed to know. Like, she didn't go online and share intimate details.
It was somewhat
she doesn't
cryptic.
Have to do that.
I tried to understand it in order to discuss it with you, and I couldn't.
Yeah.
If you listener are listening at this point, the news cycle is such that I don't think we exactly know what's happening.
Yeah. And I think that's intentional on her part for matters of privacy or other reasons such as confidentiality. And of course, we totally respect that. But I could interpret, and I feel like that's a fair interpretation, she was hurt by something in that. And that breaks my heart because, well, we know how hard it is to break out as an author, especially a woman of color. And then to have your adaptation, I mean, come on, that's so many people's dream. And then to have to distance yourself from it because of whatever reasons are keeping you, like having you do that. My heart's breaking a little bit for
her. It's not great. So, yeah. It's not a great feeling.
And then another thing that happened, we got this news today. Publishers Lunch reported that second quarter deal making is mixed. So we're going to break that up a little bit. A few highlights for you guys. Overall, we had a decline in second quarter deals. Modest decline though. So 1.8%. That's not horrible. Do you think that's horrible? No, it's not gross.
It's a rounding
error.
What
we want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not horrible. I don't want people to feel too discouraged. But then Publishers Lunch did analyze a little bit, like the data, and some highlights for you guys. They looked at the big five publishers and everyone, PRH, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, everyone's essentially, and Macmillan, everyone closed fewer deals this year than they had last year, comparing the same quarter. But Hachette was the only group where there was more deal activity. So that I thought that was interesting. Is that surprising to you?
Yeah. And I wouldn't, if you had given me, you know, a list of the big five and said, circle which one has closed more this year, I wouldn't have picked Hachette. I'm not sure who I would have picked.
I wouldn't either.
I wouldn't have said Hachette.
I think I know who I would have picked, but I'm thinking about it now. But it wouldn't have been Hachette. I agree. So, so interesting. So interesting. And then, okay, so categories, because I know you guys are going to be interested in categories. Among nonfiction categories, advice, relationship, self-help, business, finance, economics, these were the ones with the most drops. Is that how one says it?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not. These dropped.
And that didn't surprise me. And can I give you my theory?
Yeah, please. We love theories.
This is what I'm hearing. And who knows? Again, we're just theorizing.
Yeah.
Is that these are the categories most impacted by AI. Because people are going to Claude or whatever to answer questions that previously they might have gone to a book to answer.
Great.
Who knows if this is
Claude.
True? But I know.
Again.
It's not great. It's not great. No, I don't think this is good, nor do I think
I know
be going to.
It's just that every week we say, let's not talk about AI. And of course, the reason is AI. I love this feeling. Keep going. Keep going.
So do you want to hear my AI analogy about talking about AI? Because I'm talking
about hear
it
all
the time.
AI,
like this is how I think about AI. It's like, to bring it all back to dogs, it's like when a dog, you're in a room and a dog farts. We're like, is the fart welcome? No. But can you ignore it? You wish you could, but you can't. It's like, the dog farted again. That is like what every publishing conversation is. Not to be gross.
Yeah.
AI is the dog fart of publishing.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay, but you were saying that you think that the decline in these categories is because of that. That would make sense. I have heard from a few, actually, a few meaning like 3 to 4 editors that who work in imprints, who work at imprints that are focused on prescriptive fiction, that they're still going to do prescriptive fiction. It's not like they're not going to do it, but that the category is struggling a little bit.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard them make the AI connection. So that is quite interesting.
Did they give any insight into what they think is happening?
Yeah. Across the board, their theory is because there was a boom not that long ago, the decline now is just a correction. Because that we do see that after booms.
And that,
right?
That happens in every category. Yeah. You know, there's always a correction.
Exactly. So then, listeners, if you write nonfiction, but you write in the areas of religion, spirituality, history, food and beverage, and narrative nonfiction, then you can rejoice because these categories had gains. Be happy. Hope we're happy either way. Okay, and then fiction. Let's do fiction now. Fiction, there were actually gains, which was so great, and especially for debuts, sci-fi and fantasy, and thrillers. So yay, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not surprised by that.
Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, right now fiction is outselling nonfiction. So it doesn't surprise me that more publishers are acquiring fiction and that genre is selling particularly well. So none of this, nothing here is surprising me other than the Hachette bump.
It's so interesting how, I mean, I love that Publishers Lunch does this.
Same. I love the data.
Yeah, I love data. Love data will always be welcome. We'll always welcome data. Okay. So now we're going to get to some questions from our listeners. Thank you in advance to everyone who sent questions. There was one question that I rewrote with the writer's permission just because I hadn't understood it. So I had to like follow up. And then eventually I was like, hey, if I phrase it like this, are you okay with it? And they were. So we will start with that one actually.
Okay.
Okay. So it's about co-authoring. So in other words, two authors writing one book. Here's the question. I was approached by a colleague to co-author a nonfiction book on a subject we're both passionate and knowledgeable about. I've heard of books written by two authors, but to be honest, I've never mentally unpacked why anyone would choose the co-author route. Curious to hear your thoughts as agents on whether that usually means having the work, meaning cutting the work in half, or doubling the headache. So, Aaliyah, thoughts as an agent and an author?
I don't think it means having the work. I do think it's challenging. So I would approach this question with some things to think about before you agree to co-author. I've worked on a couple of co-authored books. In some cases, a different agent represented another one of the writers. In some cases, I represented both writers. And in all cases, we ended up having a good book at the end. But I've seen it be challenging, and I've seen it be challenging at other books represented by our agency. First of all, I think it's really important to, even before you approach agents, say, to set out between you both what the relationship will be like, how the work will be split, and how the money will be split. Sometimes it's 50-50, sometimes it's 60-40, and sometimes it being 60-40 can be a good thing, because maybe you can't do as much work as the other person, or you're going to do more work and you're going to feel better about it because you're getting paid more. I think it's also really good if you have distinct roles. So the reason to co-author is usually because someone is bringing a different type of expertise. So one of the books that I worked on, I'm going to try to find it, that was co-authored this was years ago. It was this book called In a Different Key, The Story of Autism, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And it had two authors. And one of the reasons that there were two authors is one author, John Donvan, was a really good on-the-page writer. His co-author, and they were both journalists, his co-author was his longtime producing partner. She was a really good researcher. And she also, it's a history, a narrative history of autism. She was a parent of a child with autism. So she had really intimate knowledge of the subject that was different than John's. And they very clearly had roles that each would fill. And in this case, too, they had different skill sets. And I think that's a good reason to co-author is, okay, one person is an amazing reporter and researcher. Another person is really great at the actual writing, which is a unique skill. And it's going to come up in one of our other questions. So, you know, otherwise I'd say, okay, well, why do I need to be there? It shouldn't be because like, we're going to do it more quickly or it's going to save time. It's not. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely agree with everything you said. I feel like it's not having the work. There's no way. I do think there are like downsides and upsides, like everything in life. Like some of the benefits have to do with something you mentioned when I was talking to you about your book, which is how isolating writing can be.
Yeah.
And so having a partner to brainstorm, share the work, that can be good if you have similar working styles. The downside, I mean, there are quite a few, but I feel like writing is such a deeply personal task, and a book's like having a vision for a book is so specific and personal that sharing that can be really stressful. And especially for things like obviously I feel like people who go into this together share a vision, but sometimes you don't know what you don't know until you start doing it.
Yes.
Things like if you're doing something solo, you can dial up and down how fast or how slow you go whenever you want. But if you're sharing with someone, it's kind of unfair to the other person. Or it could be. And so it's kind of hard to like calibrate that. I think it's really important to have a lot of trust, have a common goal, compatible working styles, and a great collaboration agreement.
Exactly.
I always say, do not accept the, oh, if something happens, we'll just figure it out. I am allergic to people who say this. I cannot stand the, we'll figure it out people. Would you do that for a business? No, you'd get a shareholders agreement. Would you do that for a marriage? No, you'd get a prenup. And if anyone's listening and going, yeah, I do that, I don't think you should. Like, talk about
and
what can happen now.
Definitely not with a business, which is what co-authoring a book is. You know?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You're going to them together and you need to be like having tough conversations like, okay, what happens if X? What happens if Y? Honestly, it can also be tricky for agents. Like, for example, I know of a situation where the authors were represented by different agents at different agencies and there was like confusion about who would handle the sub rights. So that, I mean, I also know of many situations where it's totally fine because the agents communicated and people communicated and it was all fair. But you have to be able to have tough conversations.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And what I was trying to say, before you go the route of looking for, let's say you're co-writing and you're going to agents, before you even do that, you should have a collaboration agreement with your co-author where you work it all out and it'll have everything from your financial split to what if one of you decides to pull out of the project or, you know.
These are the what ifs.
The various contingencies.
Yeah.
And I think too, the things you can disagree about, and I think it's good to have a conversation early on about books you both like in terms of style and register, because you might have different ideas of the tone of the book and you won't know that until you start working on the page. And
so
I think
true.
That's why it's really important to figure those things out early.
So true. I mean, I also think people shouldn't assume higher earnings because that's not necessarily what happens.
No.
Probably just splitting the amount that you'd get anyway. It's really important to also think about the non-compete clauses, option clauses for other works. Like, is it your solo next work or any next work by you? Like, you have to think about all these things. I'm thinking of two examples. One in fiction of two authors who were very good friends, wrote a book together, and then they had a big, big falling out. And it was heartbreaking to hear about it. I only heard about it from one of them. But it was a very fair story. The story wasn't, you know, this other person's terrible. The story was I messed up, she messed up, we both messed up. So the fact is they're no longer friends and that can hurt. I also know of an example in nonfiction where two authors wrote a book, did not have a collaboration agreement. And then after the book got a huge deal, like huge deal, one of them said, I want more than 50%. And he was like, we never actually said it would be 50-50. And he was like, yeah, it was assumed. So this is when I say don't assume. Like,
exactly.
I want your collaboration agreement to talk about copyright, monetary splits, AI use, roles and responsibilities of each party, like everything. I want
100%.
You to like, you absolutely have to do it. Like, are you going to open up an LLC? I don't know what you're going to do, but obviously think it out.
And if you can't, it's actually not dissimilar from deciding to get married. If you don't feel comfortable having that conversation with a potential co-author, then you probably shouldn't be partners on a creative and professional endeavor.
Could not agree more. Not the time to be avoidant, people.
Yes.
Not the time to be avoidant. Okay. Second question. This one is on the topic of ghostwriters and collaborators.
Not unrelated.
Yes, not unrelated. Hi, I'm an agent and writer who recently got to have calls with publishers who are interested in writing my book. Probably this person meant buying. To my shock, not one, but three publishers asked me if I planned on using a ghostwriter. One imprint said they had a strong preference for a ghostwriter. And they shared what the imprint was, but asked us to redact it. So obviously we're not going to share. Is this a common practice among nonfiction writers? Is it normal for publishers to say they strongly prefer to work with ghostwriters? Does this mean my proposal was poorly written? I wrote it myself. I have no plans on using a ghostwriter, but now I don't know if I'm making a big mistake. Obviously, we don't know, like, we do not know this person's work. And so what we always say is we're very happy to share thoughts, but thoughts cannot be advice to you specifically because that would be super irresponsible. We haven't read your proposal. We don't know what it's about. You know, this is more about
those conversations.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So Aaliyah, do you want to kick us off?
Yes. And I address this in my book. This is one of the most delicate conversations is when an author is told they should probably use a ghostwriter or a co-author. It is not the default practice for nonfiction, but it's quite common if the person is coming to write nonfiction, not because their primary job is author. So someone whose primary job is author is a journalist or someone who, you know, is a essayist or someone who is leading with writing. So that category of writer, which is the type of writer I tend to work with for my own, this is my own preferences, tend not to have a co-writer. But a lot of nonfiction is written by people who are experts in their field. Mm-hmm. So you are a well-known, you know, neuroscientist or dermatologist, or you're giving business advice. Quite often, those books are co-written or ghostwritten because the thing you're an expert in is not writing.
Yes.
And writing is a skill. It's a skill. Yes. It's a profession. It's incredibly difficult. Just because you could write a great email or even give a great talk doesn't mean you could write a whole book. And when I was writing my own book, I'd come across this a couple of times with writers who I may be interested in writing, working with because they were experts, but not writers. And I had to have the difficult conversation with them saying, I think you should hire someone. And there's always pushback because people hear that they're bad writers. Mm-hmm. And what you're hearing actually is you're not a professional writer. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed an editor I really respect, an editor and publisher I really respect, to get her like straight talk on this, Karen Rinaldi. I interviewed her in my book, and she does a lot of prescriptive books or how-to books, often co-written. And Karen used this analogy where she said, I've worked on a lot of books on neuroscience. I know a lot about the brain. No one is going to give me a scalpel and have me operate on their brain. So
what a brilliant analogy. Yes.
Right? So I would say to our friend here, if multiple publishing professionals, people who do this for a living, are interested in your book, which is a huge bar, bravo.
Yes.
Are they saying you need a writer? People who do this for a living, who judge writing for a living, are saying you need a writer. I think that's a worthwhile thing to strongly consider.
Yeah.
What do
absolutely.
You think?
I mean, I agree with you. I feel like because writing is something most of us have been doing in some form or another since we were really young in school. Like you said, people write emails. People might write even a Substack or something like that. Like it doesn't necessarily mean that you can sustain that for the long form of a book. A really good book is something that requires, both from the writing and the reading, a lot of cognitive brain power. And it is a very specialized skill. And I love the analogy you mentioned about brain surgery. Like, it is brilliant. I think it's also really important to remember that sometimes the publisher might also be coming from it from a perspective of, even if you can write, you're super busy. Like, probably because this is nonfiction, you are in a situation where you might teach courses, might give talks. You might have this impressive body of work that you have to attend to. And like writing a book requires a lot of time, not just talent, but time and like free space in your mind, you know, like it is very important. So I think that that's also part of it too. I would not be offended. I would be like, A, thrilled that you have all this interest, and
same.
B, thrilled that
Three
you're getting honest advice.
Yes,
honest advice. I love that.
And I would say too, and I hadn't thought of this until you said the thing about the time and the space. If you are an expert, again, I'm guessing by the types of publishers interested, you're an expert in a subject matter. sometimes an expert is not necessarily the best person to translate the expertise, but a professionalized writer. A professionalized writer, someone who, and there are writers who do just this, that they are ghostwriters, you know, who specialize in subjects. Like I do self-help books, I do psychology, I do business. Yeah. They'll know how to pull it out and structure it in a way that someone who's not an expert in what you are an expert in can really understand it.
Absolutely. Love that. And congratulations, listener. Congratulations. That's like super awesome that you have all this.
That's great.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about our third listener question, which we're calling Whisper Networks in Publishing. Hi, I'm an established writer on my third agent. I want to leave my current agent, but I'm worried that after three agents, any prospective agent will think I'm the problem. In the past, I've been the one to initiate termination, but it's always been amicable. Do agents ever turn down a client only because they've been represented by more than one agent in the past? My sales are mid-list, and I'm looking for someone who can really support me in my career and help me break out. My current agent is not great at communication. Before we tackle this question, in addition to my usual caveat of we do not know this person's specific experience, I want to say we have a lot of love and respect for writers on this show. And you guys know this. We also have a love and respect for everyone who supports writers. And so please don't listen to this question and think, ooh, who's the villain here? Because that's not what the question's about. I don't want anyone listening in to be like, ooh, what's happening? That's seldom the situation, right? It's usually more like about fit. So sorry, I needed to share the caveat.
I love this question because it's one I'd like to reframe. Can I reframe the question?
Do it. Yes, do it. Yes. Reframe the question. Okay. Everyone, Aaliyah's about to reframe the question.
Okay. So I think the writer might be coming at this question with the wrong questions in mind. He or she or they are worried about how they'll be perceived, and which is not something you can necessarily control. Mm-hmm. And I always give the advice that you should, in your career, worry about what you can control. What you can't, you do have a track record here. And the track record is that you've parted ways with three agents and are looking for a fourth. I do think it's worth asking yourself, well, what happened? And how do I have that not happen again? And especially if you initiated all those breakups. So that way, the next fit is one that lasts. And I think that it's really, again, it's not dissimilar. I think dating is such a great analogy for...
Disturbingly so.
So yeah, I find myself getting remarried after getting divorced, and which you don't have to do this. You don't have to get remarried after a divorce, but I thought it was really important if I'm going to do it again, make a big commitment to think about what happened in my last marriage. I think I owe it to myself and to my partner. Yeah. And this is not to say it's the writer's
fault.
Because I'm wiser. And this is not to say it's the writer's fault for these separations or the agent's fault. My guess is there were things that didn't work. That's why you separate. Yeah. So I would start from that. I would start from, okay, what happened here? And it seems like the framing of the question is my agent didn't do enough for me. But I think you should think about, well, what am I looking for in an agent? How am I going to know if the agent is the right fit? What didn't happen in these other relationships? What was good about them that I might look for? What did I like about these other agents in the past that might be things I'll look for in a new agent? So that way it's not just worrying about a whisper network, which you can't control. But you can control how you work with a future agent and what you can look for. Would it be a red flag? I would say that, again, if I talked to someone and they had parted ways with three or four other agents, I would ask what went wrong there to make sure that I was a good fit for them.
Yeah,
and that we would be happy together, and that I knew that I could give them what they wanted. So I think it's really important to have an answer for those questions that can bring an agent in so you can have an honest conversation about what a good working relationship is. Yeah, I have more thoughts, but I'm going to.
No, what do you think?
I came in a little hot there. So
I liked it. We like hot takes over here. And I also think that here's the thing for me. I thought what you said about this person wanting to control perception was brilliant, because I agree. I diagnose it the same way. I hadn't thought of it till you said it. But like when you said it, you know, when the truth feels familiar, even though you hadn't thought about it yet, like that's the impact that your words had on me. I'm like, yes, that is what this person's doing. And can I say something? I empathize because, you know, especially like, for example, as a woman, like, and we're we're perceived and judged. And like, so I understand wanting to control perception. Like,
it's human.
I understand. And I empathize, and it's human. And so like, lots of empathy and also honest advice, which is, like Aaliyah said, you can't do it. You can't control it. I know you want to, but that's like me, and I always say this, wanting kale to have the nutritional value. Sorry, wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. They're not going to have that. I definitely don't want the opposite. Unless swap. That'd be fine by me because I don't eat kale. So yeah, that's a great idea. Swap, like Freaky Friday, but for kale and chocolate chip cookies. So anyway, I think that for me, okay, if this were me, because I have spoken with writers who have been represented in the past, I always ask why they left their agent. Yep. I am not asking to pry. I am asking to audit whether I would be a good fit.
Exactly.
I need them to be honest. I'm sorry if it's an invasive question, but it's just one of those things I gotta know. What I'm most looking for, to be very honest with you, is how realistic are your expectations?
Yes.
Because I have spoken to, I'm thinking of one person I spoke to a long time ago. She was referred to me by a client of mine, and the person was honest and lovely and kind and so great. And I know they're going to have a brilliant career ahead of them. But the expectations they laid out were, in my view, not realistic. And in my opinion, not realistic of any agent, but maybe I'm wrong, maybe, right? Like, I can't speak to each other agents, but I think it's just important to be honest about what you can and can't expect. That's just the situation.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that really asking yourself, what do you expect from a new agent, and being honest with them,
yeah,
is to the benefit of both parties.
100%. Okay. Now we are at time, so we have to wrap this up. But Aaliyah, thank you so much. I'm going to hold up your great book once more.
Thank you.
So everyone can see, go ahead and check out Take It From Me, An Agent's Guide to Building a Nonfiction Writing Career from Scratch. It is an excellent book. A great guide. I really loved it. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words. Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Take care, everyone, and see you next week.
Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.